All of the newest episodes of Note to Self are now available on the Luminary podcast app. It's free to download, and you can also listen to other podcasts from WNYC studios like Radiolab, Two Dope Queens, Snap Judgment, Here's the Thing with Alec Baldwin, and others. Luminary Premium is the only place where you can enjoy the entire new season of Note to Self, plus new original podcasts you won't find anywhere else, from Trevor Noah, Roxanne Gay, Guy Raz, Lena Dunham, and many more. And you can enjoy them ad-free. Start your free trial by going to luminary.link/note to self or download the Luminary app for free.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Jordan Kovnat is the Privacy Fellow at the Fordham Center on Law and Information Policy. Jordan, thanks for coming in.
My pleasure.
So you know the story about Andrew Auernheimer. He's a self-described internet troll who's facing years in prison for taking email addresses of AT&T customers that he says he found on the internet. How come you're familiar with him?
This case has been reported a lot over the last year or so. For one, because Auernheimer, also known as Weave Online, is such a colorful character. And the other reason is that the law that he was indicted under, the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, has come under increasing scrutiny and criticism amongst internet activists and legal scholars over the last several years.
And why? Why so much scrutiny?
The main reason lately is there's an even more prominent case of Aaron Swartz, who was the internet activist and programmer who recently committed suicide. He was being prosecuted under the same law. And the reason it's getting scrutiny is because it can be interpreted very broadly by prosecutors.
Too broadly, some say. I mean, having just spoken to Andrew Auernheimer, I mean, he says he didn't hack anything. He just found stuff that AT&T mistakenly placed online.
Right.
So does the punishment fit the crime? Andrew Auernheimer is facing up to 2 5-year consecutive sentences,
right,
and $1 million in fines. That seems pretty harsh.
It's harsh in the sense that you can combine these sentences and create a very long term for activities that many of us would not necessarily think of as criminal at first blush. The way that the law is written, it penalizes the unauthorized access of a computer or someone who exceeds their authorized access. And what that means is largely up to a prosecutor to determine. Courts have accepted varying levels of what can violate the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. But for Auernheimer, for instance, what he claims is that he went to websites that were publicly available. That is, he typed in a web address at the search bar at the top of his browser, and up popped people's email addresses. And then he used a computer program to automate that process so that he could do that many, many times. But at base, his claim is he did something that anyone could do. He didn't use any particularly sophisticated hacking techniques. He didn't have to break into a computer.
Which makes you wonder, are they using Andrew Auernheimer and Aaron Swartz as, did they want to use them for examples to show people that no matter how easy it is, it's not the right thing to do?
That's possible. And you know, I can't really claim to know the rationale of the prosecutors. The critique is it gives them, those prosecutors, too much authority to define what this crime is and what is acceptable computer use, and that there's a larger critique that they're overusing this law, possibly to try and intimidate tinkerers, activists, and what are also called hacktivists, which are people that use code and their knowledge of computers to try and expose privacy flaws, security concerns, or civil liberties violations online.
I mean, it sounds like they're also taking into account intent. The fact is, Andrew Auernheimer has called himself an internet troll and said that he likes to create chaos online. Surely that did not help him. Whether or not he did anything bad with this particular instance, it does seem that they're looking at what he intended to do and what his mind frame was.
That's right. I think he probably didn't do himself any favors by making so many grandiose claims in the past. And similarly with Swartz, in his case, Swartz claimed that what he was doing was lawful as well, but the government showed video of him sneaking into a computer closet and covering his face as he connected to the MIT network as a way of showing that he must have known that what he was doing was wrong in some way. And yeah, I think you're absolutely right. These kinds of intents are being used against people.
We see that the federal government is finally sort of paying more attention. There's discussion that President Obama might release an executive order about cybersecurity this week. We know that there's something that's been introduced or discussed is Aaron's Law, this idea of changing the law that we're talking about.
The Computer Fraud and Abuse Act.
Exactly, that there's some sort of changes to be made to that. What do you think is going to happen? Where do you see it playing out?
That's an interesting question. I am not really sure because a lot of these efforts to have internet law reforms in the last several years have not gone very far for varying reasons. Last year we saw SOPA and PIPA, the big intellectual property laws that everyone thought were moving ahead full speed. They came to a crashing halt when the public and a lot of large technology companies came out against them. And there's been since then, I think, some hesitancy to push forward new laws that regulate the internet.
Why? Why? I mean, it just seems like it's something we're all doing all the time. Why would there be hesitancy?
I think for one thing, it's very hard to keep up with technology. And so when you create one of these laws, it may make a lot of sense for today, but the technology changes so much more rapidly than the law can. It takes the law years to catch up. So this law that Orenheimer was convicted of was written in 1984. Our wiretap...
I mean, that's just like, you know, the Middle Ages.
Sure. Our wiretap laws that allow the government to access things like your stored emails, that law was written in 1986. And so the technology obviously has changed a great deal since then. And I think, and because of that, the laws have come under a lot of scrutiny. And I think there is hesitancy to create a new law that could be obsolete very quickly.
So meanwhile, I'm just sort of interested, since you study this area, is there some sort of profile of these hacktivists that you see? That, I mean, this can be anecdotal, that they, I mean, to me, it seems like they're these young, super smart guys who have issues with authority, and, or are they just sort of prophets in a way, in that they see the future of this technology in ways that the people making the laws just do not?
I think that many people in that group might see themselves that way. I would hesitate to make a blanket characterization because you can see the range of behavior from just the two examples we've discussed, from Orenheimer to Swartz. They are perceived in very different ways and have generated vastly different amounts of goodwill from the public. Swartz has become somewhat of a cause célèbre amongst people who care about internet freedom. Orenheimer has generated some sympathy from that group, but more because of the legal implications of his case, more than any kind of personal support. So I think there's a range of people. There are people who just want to cause trouble online, and Orenheimer, unfortunately, was quoted saying that that's what he liked to do. He liked to cause chaos. And there are people who genuinely see themselves as reformers and who are doing these types of exploits as a way of calling attention to what they think are flaws in privacy, security, or consumer protections, for instance.
I mean, just to wrap up, I have to say that that is the thing that just keeps niggling at me. I mean, you're a lawyer. He makes some good points about large corporations needing to be taken to task for not doing their best in protecting their customers and protecting that relationship with their customers.
That's right. And many other security researchers, which is another way he's described himself, do the same type of thing that he did. The difference is they typically present their findings immediately to the company, and then the company, without going public, so that the company will argue that they need a chance to fix this before the vulnerability becomes public and other people can exploit it. He angered a lot of people by making this information that he discovered, this loophole, he made that public, and it angered many people because that's not often the most, what is seen as a legitimate way of going about this business.
I guess, I mean, in the end, I kind of feel like, I don't know, they're just like, they're obviously, their brains are working on a lot of other things, and maturity is not one of them. They like to mess with people, but surely there must be a better way of harnessing their talents.
I would hope so, yeah. These are the kinds of exploring, tinkering minds that we rely upon in advancing technologies. These are people who create the apps that we love and the search engines that we use every day. And that same kind of generative, creative mind can be put to all sorts of uses. So I think it is, in, as a society, our best interest to give people the incentives to go about this kind of work and creativity in a free, open, and productive way.
It's a good way to wrap it up. Jordan Kovnat, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.